We was hunting bear for the rocking chair out on I-40, dodging bucks in pickup trucks in West New Mexico. It was a cloudy day, and me and old Jay was just about bored to tears. But we come awake when a CB break come a-ringing loud and clear. And we heard this voice that we ain't never heard before, saying,
"Break 1-9, I'm CB Savage. Hi, all you 18-wheelers. Anyone seen any smoky bears? How about some bear smokies? CB Savage here. Come on."
Well, I looked at Jay and I said, "Hey, did you hear what I just heard?" He nodded his head and his face got red and he never said a word. We both reached for the mic, thinking we might just answer that 1-9 call, when that CB device come back to life just a lisping wall to wall. And that unusual voice came on again, saying,
"Break 1-9 again. This is your one and only CB Savage. Mercy sakes, good bodies. Could I please have your 20? I'd settle for a big 10-4. Mercy, mercy. How about a milepost? Listen, you can't keep your hammers down forever, you know. Speak to me, pedal pumpers. How about it?"
Well, the box went dead and we looked straight ahead and didn't say a word at all. We had four in the chair and the door back there, but nobody'd answer that call. A while went by and Jay and I, we started breathing again. We figured this stranger was plumb out of range when all at once he'd come back in. And it was that same odd voice saying,
"Breakers, breakers, any takers? Hi, hi, it's me again. I'm in your chair and I love it there. Say, you truckers really know how to take a person for a ride. Speak to me, you diesel demons. I'd love to get to know your handles. CB Savage here. Come on, come on."
I grabbed the mic and I held it tight and my hand began to sweat. I looked at Jay and he was grinning away like a big old bird-fed cat. So I put down the talker and turned up the squawker and got a good grip on the wheel. I decided the trucker that answered this duck sure as heck wasn't going to be me. About that time, that weird voice came back on again, saying,
"Yoo-hoo, breakaroo. Hi-hi, you jim-dandy Jimmy Jammers, you. Do I ever have a surprise for you? If you listen real close, you'll find my voice is changing. And if you'll start checking your rear views, you'll find you got company. 5 plain white smokies dressing up for a ticket writing party. Y'all were so busy copying my put on, you didn't notice your little convoy was being infiltrated. You can start shutting them down anytime now. This is your CB Savage, the Smokey's friend. Wall to wall and treetop tall. That is all. Bye bye."
Well, let's get back, boys. Well, anyhow, it's August the 26th here in the bunker. Yeah. And it's overcast today and cool. I got started off today by driving about 50 miles to see about this great big swap meet flea market deal. It's known all over the country of Shipshawana, Indiana. I had not been to it, but I decided to go. Forgot to turn off my voice to print, and it interferes with everything else. Anyhow, I went up to this thing, and well, much to my surprise, it's not really a garage sale outfit at all. It's just a damn big department store on the outside. I mean, you know, they got all kinds of tents and buildings and stuff, but it's all new stuff, all Chinese crap. So I'm glad I went and checked it out, but I'm wasted some time there, boys and girls. So anyhow, you got to watch these flea markets nowadays because they're just ramming them full of cheap Chinese shit instead of bringing the stuff in from the garage. I don't want that new stuff. I want the old stuff. Well, anyhow, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And I think everybody got their donations in for August. That's good. That's good. So we're going to start on September pretty soon here. In fact, I got a couple of donations in for September already. How about that? Well, like I said, it's cool and overcast today here in northern Indiana. I listened to this crazy-ass, what's his name? Oh, Alex Jones. I must have a mental block for Alex Jones. Somebody sent me this deal here with Duke appearing on Alex Jones. I'll comment on it in a minute. But first we got to go to our pessimist guide to history and find out what happened way back. In 373 B.C., that's before the baby Jesus, earthquakes submerges Hellas, Greece. Boy, they had a lot of earthquakes. The Greek geographer Strabo gave an account of the destruction of a city believed to be Hellas, which sank into the Gulf of Corinth during the great earthquake of 373. Another installment in the continuing saga of the Mediterranean earthquakes, which keep rearranging the Greek islands. Now, 331 B.C., the Battle of Arbela. Persia's King Darius was determined to stop the advance of the Macedonian Greek armies led by Alexander the Great before they could conquer his kingdom. To that end, King Darius assembled an army of 250,000 men, including 40,000 cavalry. Wow. 15 war elephants and 200 chariots with scythes mounted on their wheels. Woo! I'd hate to get in their way. Undaunted by the far superior numbers arrayed before him at the Arbela in Mesopotamia, Alexander attacked the Persians on October 1st with only 40,000 man infantry and a 17,000 man cavalry. With a terrifying roar, Alexander's men attacked the huge Persian army, though Alexander did hold back a reserve force from the battle. Darius sent his 200 chariots into the fray, but Alexander's men bravely ran ahead of the whirling blades and cut the traces of the horses, while other soldiers attacked the drivers and horses with javelins. The fierceness of the fighting on the right flank finally drew off so many troops that the Persian center became vulnerable. Alexander then led his reserves in the attack on the Persian center, turning the battle into a bloody rout. You should remember all these kind of battles because they can be transferred to modern times by using a little logic. Darius fled on horseback, and soon the Persians were being slaughtered remorselessly. For 50 miles, Alexander's army chopped down the fleeing Persians, thousands of whom died as they tried to force their way over a narrow bridge across the river Zab. Though estimates of the death toll vary widely, some put the Persians' losses as high as 90,000 men. Macedonian losses were less than 500, often studied as an example of the tactics of penetration. The battle upheld Alexander's genius as a general and overthrew the Persian Empire. Then on 224 BC, an earthquake topples the Colossus of Rhodes, a great bronze statue of the Greek god Apollo, one of the seven wonders of the world, stood at the entrance to the island of Rhodes until it was toppled by an earthquake in 224. Efforts to restore the 100-foot-high statue to the upright position failed. Well, there you go. That would make the Statue of Liberty pretty much of a piker compared to the Colossus of Rhodes. That must have been, wouldn't that have been something to come in there on your boat and there was this over 100-foot statue? Wow. Well, when that thing hit the water, there must have been a hell of a splash. And it eludes me how they would even have any idea of trying to re-erect the statue. However, it also, the question is, how in the hell did they ever get a 140-foot statue up in the first place? How in the hell could you do that with no levers or anything? I don't know. You tell me.
First of all, anybody that says I'm going to just be honest with you, watch out for.
Wait a minute, I have my microphone turned around. Did I record that or didn't I? Let me see here. I don't think I did.
That beginning there, you got to hear this, you know? You got to hear this. Okay, where am I at here?
As I always am, teleprompter free, telling it like it is. I'm going to be completely honest with why I have Dr. David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan Grand Dragon, joining us for the full hour into the next hour if he will stay with us. I think it's best to start this interview, this debate, this discussion this way. I never had people like Dr. William Pierce or David Duke on the show because I did not want to have a Jerry Springer-type program or Geraldo Rivera-type program. If I just wanted ratings, I could be a shock jock and, you know, be co-host with Howard Stern.
But wait a minute. Wait a minute, you fat pig. You didn't have to turn it into a shock jock thing. You should have just had a straight interview with Dr. Pierce and other people like that, people who are racially oriented. You're the one that turns it into a show, a zoo.
I mean, literally, they've talked to me before about a slot on the Howard Stern show. That is not what I have attempted to do. And I thought bringing people on like David Duke would just stir people up. And I've always been trying to get people to transcend tribal, racial systems and to have a tribe of humans based on upward mobility, based on renaissance, based on promoting ideas of.
Well, let me turn my mic around here. He doesn't want to talk about tribalism, and he goes on in and and goes into it to a great deal. But that's the heart of the racial cause, is tribalism. If it's not tribalism, what is it? He goes on to say that warfare started over tribalism. Well, yeah, to a degree, that's true. But warfare has only gotten a lot worse under Christianity and the Abrahamic religions. So anyhow, he also says in here that men fight over the women. They're fighting for the women to get the other guy's woman. Well, Robert Audrey, in his great book, The Evolution of Social Contract, will tell you, no, man does not fight, number one, for the women. Man fights for territory and feeding grounds, not the women. When he gets the territory and he gets the feeding grounds, then he automatically gets the women. And you've noticed that in society. Guys that get a lot of money, a lot of property and everything have no problem getting women. Getting, you know, the best looking women, the best genetic women, the whole bit. Yeah. So he's dead wrong on that. Of course, he's dead wrong on a lot of things. And this guy is a real flim-flam guy, you know, Alex Jones. He reminds me of the old professional double talker. Now, I don't know whether you've ever seen a double talker on TV or heard him on the radio. They used to have him every once in a while on, like, the Ed Sullivan show, the double talker. He can talk for 10 minutes and go back and forth and turn his positions around 15 times to where everybody's totally confused. And you can't nail these guys down because they change their basis for argument every 2 seconds. And you might question why Dr. Duke would go on to Alex Jones' circus show. It's quite simple. Duke knows that Alex Jones has a very large listening audience because they're low-hanging fruit. Have you heard that? They're low-hanging fruit in the right wing. They have just enough intelligence to know there's something wrong, but they leave it to these people like Alex Jones to fill in the blanks. And whenever you leave it to somebody else to fill in the blanks, you're going to get a lot of bad information. He's an expert of misinformation. And so Duke goes on there and he wants to siphon off a lot of Alex Jones' support, or even 10% of his support, because that equates into money. Now, I haven't listened to this debate yet. Duke is good at debating, but he's also a wishy-washy guy, which he switches and switches back, and a little bit like Alex Jones, only a little smoother. Well, this is a case where two sort of con men or con men get together, and it's going to be interesting to see how they manage each other. It's interesting how these people that are so-called right-wing conservatives today suddenly have painted themselves a picture that they were anti-slavery and they were anti all this stuff that the right wing has been into over the years. And suddenly now they're the champion of the Negro and so forth. If they just do it the way they want to do it, you know. I never seen a political philosophy change so fast as it has in the last 20 years or maybe 30 years. Where the right, so-called right wing, was pretty racial way back. I mean, really pretty racial. And had a lot of hard positions that were pretty much more correct than today. These guys are turning themselves into neocons and trying to say, well, we were against this and that all along. Anyhow, believe me, race is based on tribalism from the very beginning, and it'll be based on tribalism to the very end, I'll tell you that. Of course, he's talking about all these evil guys in the ruling class that will use race when they have to or when they need to screw around with your mind, the working class mind, but that is not the real tribal racialism that I know.
Quality based on systems of liberty and freedom and private property and free association. Because humans are tribal. Humans are based.
Do you notice how he likes to use those words like liberty, you know, and all that kind of stuff? These abstract terms that mean totally different meanings to different people, that when one person uses the term freedom and liberty and things like that, they may mean something entirely different than what you mean, you know. When the Negro says he wants freedom, he wants license. And the use of abstract terms are very dangerous. Because demagogues primarily use these words like freedom, equality, all of those kind of terms. They're hard to pin down and in reality don't come to the fore very much. Because what's liberty without responsibility? I mean, so anyhow, let's go from there. Well, I'm not going to play all this Alex Jones foregoing part of his show explaining how he's totally right and Duke will be totally wrong, when in fact they're both at least half wrong. And if you don't think so, have them invite me on the show. But they're not going to do that, and I don't think I particularly want to go on Alex Jones' show because I would cause him to have a heart attack. Because I wouldn't answer the same way with the same pat answers as David Duke does. I'd go for the throat, and it'd be hard for him to pin me down, that's for sure. But anyhow, beside the point, we got to get on with the show here. Fact remains, this is all about money. No matter whether it's Alex Jones or David Duke or the big shots in Washington, it boils down to money because they cannot live the lifestyle they're interested in living without quite a bit of money coming in. And it's impossible for them to be straight shooters totally because that would eliminate the low-hanging fruit of the people who follow them. They have to have a lot of people following them to get enough money and contributions to either have the nice lifestyle that they like or for other reasons. So anyhow, that's pure and simple. Whenever you try to create a big operation like that and have big membership organizations, money comes to the fore. Well, I want to read you a little bit out of a book. We're going to jump around a little bit. You're going to wonder, what the hell is he doing? Because he goes from one book to the other. Well, it's the truth and history are all over the place, and I've got hundreds of books here. And I'll pass one, see it on the shelf, and pick it up and say, hey, I ought to look into that. I read it, but I have never talked about it. So this is The World Hoax by Ernest F. Elmhurst. It was copyrighted in 1938. The premise, history, an experiment. Walk up to the average American today and ask him to tell you what communism is, or for that matter, predatory capitalism. Everybody knows what communism is, he responds, surprised and not a little nettled at having a question so childish put to him. Well, what is it? Well, it's a worldwide political party originating in Russia that's fighting by revolutionary methods to destroy predatory capitalism. It invites the workers of the world to enjoy the same rights that have always been enjoyed by the aristocratic classes with influence and money. No more. What do you mean, more? But where do the Jews come in? What Jews? All Jews, all over the world. You know that communism, with its ghastly blood glut, wherever you find it, is confessedly Jewish, don't you? That's Jew-baiting Nazism. I don't believe in Nazism. I believe every race has a right to worship God as it pleases. Well, what's worshiping God got to do with it? Well, Jews are persecuted because of the way they worship God, aren't they? And that's against the Constitution. It's un-American. Besides, it's race prejudice, unquote. But from what you've seen of communism here in the United States, you'll agree it's mostly Jewish-financed and Jew-led, won't you? Well, the Jews have always been downtrodden and persecuted for their religion, just like the downtrodden in mass production. It's not to be wondered at that as a race they make common cause with all the enemies of the Aryan capitalism, huh? One thing about these books back then, many of them didn't attack capitalism as much as they should have, because they would be afraid to be called Marxist. Then you believe in sticking up for the Jews regardless of whether or not they're making common cause with a political party that is seeking to overthrow all governments by violence? Your average American suddenly becomes disgruntled then and warily angry. Well, they're God's chosen people, aren't they? The Bible said so. The Bible's been rewritten about 7 times since the ascension of the make-believe Christ. How much investigating have you done to find out whether the Jews are God's chosen people or not, or whether that's something they've put forward themselves to gain a religious edge over Christians or Aryans? I see. You're one of them Nazis. Well, being a Nazi, what's being a Nazi got to do with the facts behind this business of bogus claims by the Jews? So they have an excuse to overthrow all governments by violence? I don't know. I don't care. But I'm an American, and I'm against race prejudice. You asked me what communism is, and I answered you. No, you didn't answer me. You said communism was merely a political party. Well, what else is it? Karl Mordecai didn't say so, and he should have known. Who's Karl Mordecai? The person you know as Karl Marx. Marx wasn't his real name, you understand. He was only an alias he used to cover up the fact that he was a Jew. The same as the Russian Finkelstein gets himself accepted under the bogus name Litvinov. I never knew Marx's real name was Mordecai. What of it? Mordecai or Marx never claimed that communism was political. He had other ideas and said so frankly. Well, what did he say? He said his theory of scientific socialism, that later became communism in practice, was simply a means of smashing all Gentile governments so that the Jews might become emancipated and supreme over the Gentiles or Aryans. Marx said that? It was the premise of his whole career. It resulted in communism as you know it. The newspapers never put it so. I don't find it anywhere in the communist literature. So you're familiar with communist literature? Well, I try to keep up with what's going on. Then why haven't you kept up with what's going on in Germany? If you keep up with what's going on and read the communist literature, why don't you read a little bit of Nazi literature to balance up and give you both sides? I told you before, I'm against race prejudice. Well, you believe in class prejudice. Who said I did? Well, you don't express the same angry opinion about communists setting class against class. You don't say that it's un-American. I didn't aim to start no argument. You asked me to tell you what I understood about communism. I let you have it, and now you try to sell me on becoming a Nazi. Well, I couldn't be one if I thought you were right. I do business with Jews, and I owe them a lot of money. The Jews get sore if you don't fall in with this planning of Hitler. And besides, I've got two boys and a brother on PWA. If the administration heard that I was anti-Jewish, it might make my relatives a lot of grief. And determined to put a halt to your Nazi Jew-baiting, Mr. Average Citizen walks off and will have no more to do with you. His colossal ignorance about what's going on is not only tragic, it's heartbreakingly pathetic. All that he has expressed in this conversation is a parroting of what he has had dinned into his ears so long and so insistently by America's kept press. Tincture with its progressive doctrines of liberalism that he actually believes he has been expressing his honest convictions, that on the whole you were disposed to sell him on substituting some fascist form of government for constitutionalism. Henceforth he recalls you as an exceedingly dangerous person, having run around loose in the body politic. Jews in the aforesaid kept press have contrived to create that conviction in him also, to agitate for the overthrow of constitutionalism by violence, or even through New Deal legislation in the name of liberalism, makes no one particularly dangerous. But to imply that international Judah may have picked up and promoted the anti-Gentile system of Karl Mordecai, alias Marx, in order to pull down Aryan culture and substitute the Jewish, exempting itself from any possible retributions by charging up the whole bloody business to the proletariat of the world fighting for its rights, converts you into a public enemy number one, and the La Follette Committee in the Senate or the Dyes Committee in the House of Representatives should investigate you pronto. You are engaged in preaching fascism in this nation, and fascism, holy horrors, might succeed constitutionalism. Now, America is filled with millions of foregoing average citizens whose attitudes on communism, fascism, and Nazism are dictated by the fact that they do business with Jews daily or owe them money or concede that this current administration is Yiddish, else a possible losing of their jobs on the PWA would not be the implied penalty for talking against Jews openly. The nation is likewise filled with other millions of more erudite Gentiles or Aryans, not beholden to the PWA or for any jobs, who are commencing to note the Jewishness of communism. The Jewishness of our federal government and its crackpot schemes for rescuing the country, and the well-nigh disgusting Jewishness of the representative daily press, these two classes are clashing hourly with growing bellicosity in every section of the public domain. Sooner or later, this sort of thing is heard. You say communism is Jewish, challenges the liberal-minded gullible. I certainly do, the wiser man affirms. Well, how can you prove it, aside from the fact that a great numbers of persecuted Jews flock into it to get them their rights, the same as the workman, working man. In 9 cases out of 10, the more educated Aryan or Gentile is immediately nettled and at slight loss. He knows that there is 100 instances where Jews themselves have boasted of the Jewish character of communism and its sponsorship. But where and how to put his hands on such statements or fetch forth documentary proof to support his contentions is at the instant beyond him. Truth to tell, he actually must reach the press of the nation and perhaps the political economic literature of the last generation for devastating weapons to show his scouring correctness of the position. Well, the time has come when such plight may be remedied. Why has no one written a book to date exclaiming the sincere critic of communistic Jewry, presenting the admitted hookups between Judah and Bolshevism? The demand is a fair one. In response to its persistence, this volume in your hand has found literal expression. Communism, as you will now be shown, was hatched by a Jew, and a particular disgusting one at that, kept alive by Jews, financed by them at the close of the World War, is staffed by them, installed by them in every country wherein it has taken its blood toll, and at the present moment is being promoted a lecherous victory in our Christian land or Aryan land by certain especially rapacious sons of Judah, whilst thousands of other Jews brag openly of its success and readily concede its Jewish character and purpose from high tomorrow. The only way to convince the Aryan or Gentile gullible that such statements are by no means fascist propaganda birthed in race prejudice is or serving the excretations of religious persecution is to give them the simple but devastating life stories of the Jewish gentlemen who have been communism's patrons from the first. Who was Karl Mordechai Marx, and how did he come to project communism at the start? Who was Lenin? Who was Trotsky? Who was Bela Kun? The whole devil's spawn of apostate Jews, 276 of them from New York's East Side, who swarmed into Russia at the birth of the Bolshevik Revolution and clapped machine guns to the heads of the white Russian people. What hookups has Stalin, the present red dictator, with officious world Jewry as we behold it today? This volume, this book, puts the whole documented narrative into your hands at last. For instance, reference henceforth when the enlightened non-Jew is challenged by his critics. Endorse it or don't endorse it, as you prefer, but the Jew or non-Jew is not alive today who can refute the ensuing facts. And this is a book. It's about 200 pages called The World Hoax. Like I say, it was copyrighted 1938. I don't know how much it gets into Jew capitalism here, because the problem is in the old days, They bailed the cat about Jewish communism all the time, but they did not adequately attack Jewish predatory capitalism. And nowadays we're getting more back into that, but back then they didn't do that, and which was only half of the argument. It wasn't hard to figure out when you know that the whole Bolshevik Revolution and the communist thing was financed by the big banks in New York City. So what else do you need to know? Does the tail wag the dog? Does the tail wag the dog? I see the Glenn Miller trial has begun, and it's too bad because there are going to be a lot of things screwed up in this trial. It's going to be an attack on all of us, even though Miller was, well, we've talked about Miller many times. He's defending himself with a defense based upon the idea that because Jews are committing a genocide against the white race, he has an obligation to kill them. He intends to use the trial as a platform to present evidence against the Jews. Well, the problem is that it's not just the Jews. I mean, it's the Republican Party. It's the Democrat Party. It's tremendous numbers of leaders who are not Jewish at all. And Miller, like a lot of right-wingers, has a one-track mind. It's just the Jews, just the Jews. If we just could take care of the Jews, everything would be fine. But that's not true. The judge has already, however, restricted him on what he's going to be able to say. And it's really sad that the right wing of the racial struggle could not have been properly straightened out long ago. And it just keeps continuing down the same old path, and to where they don't want to listen to any of us because many of these people go out and do crazy things, and they're not even strategically correct. I mean, like killing several people who are not even Jewish. If your main thing is Jewish, you'd think Miller would have got it right. But here's the problem when you get to people like Miller. He was a drunk. And there's a lot of people have side issues that cause them to go off the rails. Even though Glenn Miller was not an intellectual giant, see, the problem is when you have a drug problem or an alcohol problem or in some cases a woman problem or whatever, it can warp your thinking to the point where whatever you do as an act for your race is usually wrong. Now, when Miller in court tried to make his statement, Judge Thomas Kelly Ryan interrupted Miller's statement and said he couldn't present to jurors his belief that the mainstream media and the Federal Reserve are controlled by Jews, or argue that Jewish people are committing genocide against the white race. Well, technically that gutted his whole defense. Quote, you are telling me that I don't have a chance at all of being found not guilty, Miller said. I want to present my defense and explain why I did what I did. Well, yeah, anybody that's charged with a capital crime should be able to say almost whatever they want in their defense. I agree with that. You know, alcoholism has done a lot of damage to our struggle. And even though I'm not telling people not to drink, but drinking, either not drink or in moderation, we've had several people that were could have been very important in the struggle have gone down due to their alcoholism. Dennis Mahon is one of them. Frazier Glenn Miller is another one. There's been several, and there's a whole lot of skinheads in prison for life or for a long time because of alcoholism and now, of course, drugs. If you're going to adequately have a program to fight your enemy, you can't be messed up with opiates in your mind or alcoholism. Now, that, like I said, that doesn't mean that you can't do a little bit of this. If a guy wants to have a marijuana cigarette, I don't think that's going to change his ability to operate in his struggle, or to have two or three drinks is not going to do it, or at least don't do any activity when you are drinking. But when you let alcohol and drugs enter the picture for any length of time and for any many hours of the day, you can't think properly. And you're going to, if you're going to make a political act, it's not going to work, and you're going to probably do something that's going to do irreparable harm to the people you're trying to help. I know for the at least two or three, four or five years before Dennis Mahan got into trouble with this thing in Phoenix, he was drinking Everclear. Now, Everclear is a commercial white lightning. It's extremely powerful. And it's not recommended to drink it at all, but in a small quantity, a shot, maybe once in a while, would not be bad. But Mahan got into a habit of drinking Everclear, which screwed up his mind and led him into this situation where he's now doing 40 years in prison. People tend to do things under the influence of alcohol or drugs that they would never have thought of doing when they have a straight when they're straight thinking. And that's been proven over and over again. You know, it's quite interesting that the people who swear this eternal struggle against the Jew and all that become habitually connected to the very product that the Jews control. Especially hard liquor is controlled very much by the Jews. So here are white Aryans that are getting into the habit of drinking hard liquor, and at the same time talking about stopping the Jews. So that doesn't make good sense. And also the Hollywood Nazi types that seem to forget that Adolf Hitler did not drink alcohol, and he didn't even like cigarettes. So why would these young guys that say they love Adolf Hitler get tied into drinking and drugs? No, it just shows that it's all a phony bunch of crap, Hollywood Nazism. Well, Trumpism keeps rolling right along, and I know how many people out there, including probably many that tune into this program, are sort of thrilled about what he says and what he does, but you must always remember that Trump has a facade, and Trump is a billionaire, and when somebody's a billionaire, they could not have gained all that money by being truly the friend of the white race and the white working class. Now, I think it's interesting to watch him maneuver around, and I think it's fun, and it's sort of like comedy TV, how it affects the other side, because the other side goes absolutely, absolutely, totally bananas. I mean, and I'm all for that. Anytime you can drive the media crazy, but you can see the heart of the situation is that this is the way they treat anybody that wants to operate outside what's accepted in the political arena. Now, it doesn't make any difference whether it's Trump or who it may be. They're going to attack him exactly the same way if they adopt any positions like taking care of all the excess Mexicans in the country and things like that. Anybody that says anything along those lines or anything that's pro-white and might be a little anti-black, they're going to attack the same way. Now, he hasn't even attacked the blacks. Now, there a lot of people on the right wing are reading into his statements that he may be anti-black, but that's not true, especially because the blacks can serve his interests in the labor force and so forth. He's not going to be overtly racist. So anyhow, it doesn't make any difference whether it was him or whether it was even Goldwater back in the old days said some things, you know. And then you had John Schmitz who ran for president. The media is all geared up. The Jews are all geared up. The predatory capitalists are all geared up, and even the courts and the federal courts, to rule against anybody that's coming from the outside. And so they'll put up people like this once in a while just to test the water of how radical the public is really becoming. And if there's any way of heading them off, that they might really rise up in a true, righteous, civil war and so forth, they're going to do it. And so anyhow, don't get excited about this. And also, don't go out and do something crazy in support of Trumpism. Just sit back, have a beer, and laugh a lot. And especially watch these left-wingers, Jews, and so forth, these progressives, go crazy. I know that Mike Malloy is a big, you know, progressive, and he just goes absolutely, totally berserk about Trump. Which is good, because in a way, some of the things he brings out, it sticks in people's minds, and they're going to stick in their mind no matter what happens to Trump. So, anyhow, enjoy the ride. But remember, if voting would change things, they'd make it illegal. Did you notice how Wall Street went crazy the other day on the possibility that the crash had come when the Chinese markets dropped, what, 1,000 points or something? I don't know, but anyhow, it's amusing to me of how the chickens all jumped in the air at the same time, squawking, squawking. The sky is falling. And the sky is going to fall. But this was a false alarm. Well, not necessarily a false alarm, because it's still, the market is still down several, 200 or 300 points, I guess. So I don't pay much attention to that stuff. I just wait here in the bunker, hoping and wishing for the crash. Yep, Huffington Post and YouTube and all that stuff. I've been banned from that stuff for a long time. But yet they keep talking about freedom of speech all the time. We gotta fight for freedom of speech. Both the progressives and the neocons. We gotta have free speech. But the minute either myself or somebody who could say it even better than me tries to put something up there, it's taken down immediately. Get that shit off of there. You know, there's another cult out there that's becoming pretty powerful, and I hadn't heard about it before. It's interesting that the guy heading it up is George King. George King was a personal friend of mine, but this is a different King. Anyhow, it's AETHERIUS.org. And they meet up in Royal Oak, Michigan on Sundays. Supposedly they're linked up to the aliens in space somehow. So another cult out there that's gaining ground. Here's a comment from one of our listeners. Dear Tom, ask many black people in Detroit, Michigan, when I drive food to factories and residential areas, and I ask them about ISIS. Hold on a second. Believe it or not, I can find up to 5 or 6 niggers each day who claim they never heard of ISIS. And because of that genius Ronald Reagan saying that Gaddafi is a madman from the Middle East, you can still find many people, both black and white in Michigan, who still haven't clued into the fact that Libya is actually in Africa and not in the Middle East. I even find 1 or 2 white pink Polacks in Michigan every day who still haven't yet heard of ISIS. But they all heard of Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King. Let's see, what happened to my... Incidentally, we have stickers coming. That shipment of stickers I told you about is on the way. Now, it's just the non-equal sign in a circle. And also, we didn't put a address or a name on it. The first run, we're going to try like that. And then if we decide, we'll put the name on it. The most important thing in my mind is to get the symbol out there. Symbols are extremely important. And that's an easy one to understand if you got a half a brain. And like I said before, you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll send you some as an example and for you to get them out, because they're not going to be any good unless you spread them far and wide and put them on your mail or put them on prepaid envelopes that you get from all these companies wanting to sell you something. This was an interesting interview with a lady who had been in Auschwitz. She was a teacher, librarian at this person's school in Middlesex, England, obviously after the war. During the mid-70s, we had many conversations about her time in various concentration camps. Our conversations must have been more or less immediately after she was recorded for the Shoah Archives of Steven Spielberg and the boys. Anna also told me some things that she probably did not feel able to speak of on the tape. She was an Austrian Jew and an orphan. She was fiercely pro-German and stated that the German peoples were the world's best hope against Marxism. She was nevertheless sent to Auschwitz at the age of around 13 or 15 and was in one of the earliest groups of Austrian Jews sent there. TT thinks that whole program was screwed up and it was one size fits all, and that's my opinion, is that was a big mistake. When I asked why an orphan would be in the camps, she shrugged and suggested anyone could fall through the net or be caught up in a net. I cannot recall exactly which other camps she was sent to. It was a long list. But I do recall that she said she passed briefly through Treblinka, which she described as just a transit camp. She said Ravensbrück and Majdanek were not so good as Auschwitz, that her time at Auschwitz was really quite acceptable in the main, that being able to work alleviated the chronic boredom, and at least initially, when they went to the surrounding work camps, they were always driven in trucks, and only much later they had to walk everywhere. Overall, she attributed her survival as being due to the strong group of Jewish women in her block, as they included professional doctors, and they looked out for her as well. Hold it. Whoa, wait a minute. I went too far. Anna was very clear about there being no lethal gas chambers. She said everyone knew the slightest details about everyone's business. There were no secrets. It would have been impossible for such things as mass gassings to have occurred. She described the real difficulties at Auschwitz arising first and only when the Hungarian Jews arrived. She implied that they were generally so spoiled by servants doing everything for them, and even rudimentary hygiene was beyond them, i.e. the higher up the food chain, the further from reality they were, but also that they were very aggressive and manipulative. She described how things got steadily worse until things reached a nadir once the food became increasingly scarce and the people were literally murdered in their beds just because it was thought they might have had secreted some bread on their person. Anna described the universally described capos as being the real ruthless reign of terror of the camps, and that the capos would even throw other Jews into the ovens alive in order to cement their authority over the others with fear. All this, Anna said, changed with the arrival of a young English prisoner of war called Langmaid, who had snow-white hair and had been captured in Italy, and as a serial escapee had been sent to Auschwitz, but who was still fit enough to stand up to the capo gangs. And so he fought several battles, beat a number of capos unconscious, and even threw several of them alive into the ovens, thus breaking the intimate spell of the other remaining capos. Anna described him as an angel and said that his arrival was like a new golden age, though, of course, food was still very short and sickness and death still prevailed. At the liberation of Auschwitz, she described how they were only then given number tattoos as a part of the quarantine process. She brought in a liberation photograph taken of her with some other women of her barracks. I could not immediately pick her out. She looked younger than I imagined she would, but in the photo she was on the far right front of the picture. Apparently, one of the other women in the picture, who was wearing a bandage over her tattoo due to some minor infection, went on to later become a well-known and much-lauded camp survivor spokesman of the official narrative, but that all the other women in this photograph thought badly of her for being so easily persuaded and prepared to overtly play the victim and support the false storyline. At this time in the mid-70s, the Holocaust industry was still picking up steam. It would be about 18 months before our first classroom lesson on the Holocaust. Anna said that she and other ex-camp inmates were well aware that there was an attempt being made to gain political mileage from the wartime events. I asked her why they didn't all speak out together against this, and she indicated that for a Jew, the threat of social ejection was very grave business, and that in any case she was content to have her sole claim to fame being the writer of a children's book about a train. She wrote a book that is part of the series The Little Train That Could. Anna Schreiber was someone I liked and respected very much, and I never forgot her account of Auschwitz. Over the years, I read the accounts from Auschwitz and other wartime books, during which I came across a few other small, vague snippets about this mysterious rescue. About 20 years ago, I found out some more about the man Langmaid from a colleague of his who worked in connection with the Nottingham Mental Institution. At that time, Langmaid was dying, and so I could not meet him personally. Then about 12 years ago, I met a daughter of Frances Langmaid when she moved next door and was able to find out more of the details. We are no longer in contact, and at last I heard was his family were working on a book, though I do not wish to steal their thunder. I feel I can now give a rough sketch of the circumstances that brought Frances Langmaid to Auschwitz. Like Anna Schreiber, Frances Langmaid, it seems, was destined to be another Auschwitz-bound orphan. He was raised as an orphan Catholic in Retford, Nottingham, England. During the war, he arrived in Singapore with the Sherwood Foresters just in time for the surrender there, and so became a prisoner of the Japanese. He soon found himself laboring with a work detail digging an air raid shelter when Allied planes flew high above them, and panicked the guards began throwing grenades into the trench and bayoneting the prisoners. Only a few escaped alive, and in confusion he escaped. Francis made his way for many miles across extremely difficult terrain, avoiding the natives who were at the time very pro-Japanese and very much anti-white, a legacy, ironically, of historical Jewish-Dutch abuses, though that would soon change once they had a taste of their new Japanese masters. At times he briefly joined up with other Allied stragglers, but where they faltered, he pushed on. Eventually he found an Italian ship and was taken aboard as a crew. Being Catholic presumably helped him here. He arrived in Italy in 43 and managed to find shelter and even started a family, but was betrayed and captured by the Germans in 44. When Italy surrendered, he escaped again, was recaptured, and as a repeat POW was sent to Auschwitz. His experience at Auschwitz has already been sketched. For his exploits, he was awarded the Victoria Cross, though with so many ex-servicemen, he was just left to get on with the readapting. He found the return to civilian life difficult. He married and started another family and found work at Rampton Top Security Mental Institution in Nottinghamshire before he eventually succumbed to alcoholism. Interesting.
The Steven Spielberg-produced documentary The Last Days was released. film focused on chronicling the experiences of five Jewish-Hungarian Holocaust survivors. It was released to rave reviews and won the 1999 Academy Award. One star of the film claims to have repeatedly defecated and swallowed diamonds for a year and a half while in Auschwitz and on death marches. She also claims to have been selected to have her skin turned into a lampshade, claims she had her tattoo removed by Dr. Mengele, and also escaped from inside a gas chamber.
I think that was Mengele that took me out of there. And he just attached me to that gypsy person, and I went to the gas chamber. And as I was going into the gas chamber, you know, everybody was being pushed into the gas chamber. And I was going backwards. Somehow I was being pushed backwards, and I was like stuck in the door. And I guess God told me to do that.
Incredibly, another star of the last days also claims to have escaped from inside a gas chamber. This star survivor claims to find evidence that her sister was experimented on in Auschwitz.
I found out that my sister was experimented on, that they were doing some blood tests on her.
She confronts a Nazi doctor, acquitted of war crimes, who denies anything sinister took place.
No, nothing important. No.
Was keine Experimente, war das?
Es ist nichts. Es ist alles gut, alles gut, alles gut.
This black American soldier, featured prominently in Spielberg's documentary, claims to have stormed the beaches of Normandy and liberated Dachau. However, wartime documents prove he was hundreds of miles away at the time of both events. The tagline of The Last Days is "Everything you're about to see is true." In the following presentation, you're going to witness the overwhelming amount of evidence which proves that the Holocaust documentary, The Last Days, is in reality Steven Spielberg's big lie.
Well, after doing a lot of research, get my microphone back over here. After doing a lot of research, especially into the agreement between Germany and the Zionists, that they made the agreement to work together, I'm of the conclusion that this truth would have come out and would have been really promoted, which would have blown the whole story. And because there are, at the end of the war, there were 3 million Jews already in Palestine. So Germany let a hell of a lot of Jews out and even helped them get to Israel or Palestine. So my theory is very simple. They needed something so bestial and so bad and so horrible of a story that would have just overshadow every discussion from here on in for 50 or 100 years. However, it's sooner or later all going to come out. But that's what the Holocaust story is about. Not that a lot of people didn't die due to various diseases and so forth and lack of food and all this, unintended circumstances, but the Zionist-German agreement may have said, well, yeah, we're going to lose some. That's just the way it goes. The plan was to move millions of Jews into Palestine. And that was what was attempted. And but they're desperate to keep this secret from the general public. And what better to do, because you had the camps there, you know, you could see the camps. It'd be easy to dummy up and lie about a whole bunch of stuff and make it so bad, dastardly story, and get credit, a lot of these Jews to come up and lie. And some of them are psychotic and giving crazy stories that anybody would try to bring the other out in the open would be totally discredited. And also, neither side wants it to come out. Israel sure don't want to come out, have it come out that the Zionists were working. And Zionism was what created Israel. I mean, that was the political thing.
So the Zionists don't want it to come out that they were hand in glove with the SS and everybody else. And the Germans don't want it to come out. At least most Germans don't want it to come out. So the story is sort of left in limbo. I say that that story will be told one day, and much of the crap against Germany will be vindicated, especially about these concentration camps and like that. So anyhow, always start digging about this Zionist Nazi connection. There's the key to the whole story. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. Yeah, Thursday. In the meantime, 14:5, and remember, above everything else, I have nothing to say.
Well, I was thumbing from Montgomery. I had my guitar on my back. When a stranger stopped beside me in an antique Cadillac. He was dressed like 1950, half drunk and hollow-eyed. He said, "It's a long walk to Nashville, would you like to ride?" I sat down in the front seat, he turned on the radio. And them sad old songs coming out of them speakers was solid country gold. Then I noticed the stranger was ghost white pale when he asked me for a light. And I knew there was something strange about this ride. He said, "Drifter, can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid your dues? Can you mourn the blues? Can you bend them guitar strings?" "Cause if you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride." Then he cried just south of Nashville, and he turned that car around. He said, "This is where you get off, boy, 'cause I'm going back to Alabama." As I stepped out of that Cadillac, I said, "Mister, many thanks." He said, "You don't have to call me Mister, Mister. The whole world called me Hank." He said, "Drifter, can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid your dues? Can you mourn the blues? Can you bend down guitar strings?" He said, "Boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? But if you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride." "Drifter, can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid your dues? Can you mourn the blues? Can you bend them guitar strings? You said, boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? But if you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride. If you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride."